Accession number 8256, Reel 2.
Mr. Osborne, Reel 2. Do you have any special memories about the signing of the Atlantic Charter as you experienced it?
Yes, I remember being in Scapa Flow when the destroyer came alongside. We weren't allowed aft of the superstructure. We were on the forecastle. And we had no idea who was coming aboard, and someone said, "It's Churchill." And we all peered, and no one saw anything, but someone said, "It's Churchill, I saw him." And indeed it was. And we had a lot of, I was going to say important people, but then everyone is important, senior people on board. And we made our way across the Atlantic, rather, as I remember, heavy weather. We went fairly fast. Don't know how fast the Prince of Wales could do. She used to do 25 knots quite a lot. But I'm certain that she was capable of 30, perhaps more. But we steamed fairly fast across the Atlantic. Rough weather, we left the destroyers behind. Eventually we did get three Canadian destroyers. Remember, they were the old I think they were A-class, about 1933. Perhaps you know.
No.
No. I think they were A-class, 1933. Can't remember the names. Probably can't remember them because they're inevitably French or Sioux names or something like that, and I wouldn't be able to pronounce them. I do remember that we arrived off Newfoundland. We prepared the ship for entering harbour, you know, lots of little things to do to get a ship ready to go into harbour. We worked for a while, and we didn't realise that the American fleet were using their own time, and we were working by Newfoundland time. So we were ahead of time, but we thought that our commander, who complimented the captain. Captain was tall, elegant, beautifully dressed. Commander was shorter, ugly, and occasionally ran up forward on the forecastle in his bare feet. Anyway, we got to Newfoundland early, and we had to steam around for a while, but we didn't know this at the time, and we thought it was our commander playing one of his tricks. And I must say, I don't know anyone who resented his ability to get people to work. He had a nickname. We called him Nickabit, because he used to nick a bit of time here and nick a bit of time there. Don't know how generally this was known, but to us who had to work with him, very, very true. But it was his organisation. If I may come back to that, because I would have to digress from the Placentia Bay. Eventually we were met by some American destroyers that seemed to steam around haphazardly, full speed. And they led us into this huge bay. I didn't realise it was a bay at first. It was enormous. There were, there's the Arkansas battleship. I remember the Augusta, which was Roosevelt's cruiser. And the destroyer that used to act as the ferry, the McDougal. And we went in, and we anchored at a buoy which had been placed there for us, and somehow the captain managed to do it almost to the minute. I I don't remember the chain of events or what happened. It was rather strange, but I did notice that I don't know whether you've been on a warship, but every door you go through, there's a combing. The door fits against the steel bulkhead, and there is a step over into the next compartment of what, some 8 or 9 inches? Probably about 8 or 9 inches. And a lot of these had ramps put down on either side to take a chair or something. I didn't know a chair at that time. I think by saying chair, I, acting with hindsight, had no, it was obvious that something had got to be wheeled over these ramps, and we didn't know what it was. But then, of course, Churchill, when he came aboard the Prince of Wales, it was obvious that he was not able to walk any distance, and he had a wheelchair.
Roosevelt.
Did I say Churchill?
Yes. And
Roosevelt had this wheelchair which he used from time to time on the Prince of Wales. But in most of the photographs that were taken, you all saw him standing, and we were asked not to tell the people at home that Roosevelt did use a wheelchair. I was side party once or twice, and there's a rather embarrassing photograph because I was a rather serious young man, and I standing to attention in the side party, deadly serious, and everyone smiling. Everyone else smiling. It's an embarrassing photograph to me. Two things that stand out in my mind. One was the church service that was held on board on the Sunday, day after we got there. I think it's one of the most impressive sounds and sights I've ever seen. I know we had King George the Fifth on board, King George the Sixth, sorry, on board when we were in Rosyth at one time. It had lots of things happening, but that church service was most impressive. The sound of, what, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000 men's voices. I don't know how many men came from the American ships. There were a fair sprinkling throughout the quarterdeck, but I think it's true to say, from where the Beaufort's gun was right aft, Churchill, Roosevelt sat to the starboard side, followed the Beaufort's gun, and the lectern was probably just in front of it. Yes, probably almost amidships, little to port. And you, from that point forward, you couldn't put another person. It was solid. It was all standing like this. And they were the usual popular hymns, if I may use the word popular, but the one was the sailor's hymn, the Eternal Father, and that is the one that was so impressive, to listen to this crescendo of voices going across the water. Something about male voice choirs that is impressive. And after the service broke up, a lot of people disappeared below. We mingled around the quarterdeck. People were taking photographs. Unfortunately, I hadn't got a camera. Most of the people I knew hadn't got cameras, but there was one man who had got a camera. And something I would like to come back to about cameras. Churchill had even arranged people in groups for photographs. I can remember standing there seeing him arrange these people into groups. Uh, almost lost a cat as well when she, I'm not sure whether she or he, tried to go aboard the MacDougall. Churchill stopped it. I don't think anyone dared move to stop it. I thought about it, but I hadn't got the courage to. And the MacDougall sailed away. The interesting thing is that the MacDougall came along the starboard side from Porrad, and her forecastle, which is virtually their officers' quarters, or the equivalent of their quarter deck, came alongside our quarter deck. And although she was a destroyer, she was, as I remember, not far below the Prince of Wales quarter deck. Whether the MacDougall was chosen for the various heights from the water, I don't know. The other thing I remember about that meeting in Placentia Bay, Churchill wanted to go for a picnic, and I was on the quarterdeck at the time, and I had to go to the bottom of the ladder, hold the whaler inboard, in against the companionway, and crossed my mind to try and hand Churchill into the boat, but I had a feeling he wouldn't like it. So I just held the whaler in to the companionway while he stepped aboard. And she was towed by a motorboat to a picnic shore. I didn't see him coming back from that picnic, but no doubt he enjoyed himself on the beach. He seemed to enjoy every minute of the trip. He invariably had a melon smile on his face.
Did you get a close-up view of Roosevelt?
Very close, very close. I was, as I said, side party. I don't know. You would see, it was on the other side. This is the port side of the ship. And I was in side party there. The gangway went across to the MacDougall, just a matter of feet away.
This is well aft.
Oh, yes, it was well aft. It was between the aft. It's not very clear on this, about the only photograph I've got of the Prince of Wales. It's not very clear here, but there's a little bit of superstructure there, the boat deck going along to the after structure there, a little bit of superstructure, and then the after turret, and in between the screen with the door. Or almost opposite that door is where the MacDougall arranged for the gangway to be come aboard.
Did Roosevelt look very sick?
Not to me at that time, but then, you know, I think as a boy I wouldn't know if anyone really looked sick. I don't think, I can't give you an honest answer to that. I can't say that he looked well or not. I think he would have had to have looked very bad for me to have recognised that he was ill. One could see that obviously there was something wrong, because he was in the wheelchair from time to time.
What was his demeanour?
He was pleasant. He seemed to have a smile. He leant on people when he was standing or leaned against something. But I didn't see him at close quarters talking to anyone, apart from when he left. He spoke to Churchill, or Churchill saw him off the ship. Saw him talking to Churchill during the service. Well, of course, he was sitting down then, and sat down through the service. Another thing is the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Navy, and that was, of course, Roosevelt, he sent a little parcel across for every member of the ship's company, which consisted of it. About 200 cigarettes, apples, oranges, cheese, and a compliment slip. Lots of people I know save the cigarettes to take home as souvenirs, but I smoked mine and I sent her home the compliment slip.
How were the presents received?
By the people?
Yes.
We were all thrilled with them. With all the people I knew, because I think perhaps, as far as I was concerned, having, as I said before, learned to smoke at great expense, and I had a dickens of a job to learn to smoke to join the others. I was glad of the cigarettes, because as a boy seaman, I was only allowed 3 shillings a week from my money. And 3 shillings a week, even in those days, was not a lot for a boy seaman with nothing to do, nowhere to go, just chocolate and cigarettes. But even that didn't go very far.
Can we go on now to the voyage to the Far East later in 1941? Can you tell me how you got there?
Yes, we went down from, again, Scapa. We seemed to spend an awful lot of time at Scapa, moving from Scapa down to various places. We went from there down to Greenock. I'm not sure, at all sure, end of October-ish, beginning of November. I should have looked it up, I suppose. And what I remember of Greenock was a drab, drizzly, miserable day, cold and wet. And we picked up some RAF officers and we moved out with a convoy out into the Atlantic. Quick run, presumably about halfway across the Atlantic, and then round into Freetown. A couple of days in Freetown. I went into Freetown itself and someone knew a shortcut, and we had to cross this river, and the does one call them natives nowadays? Anyway, we called them natives in those days. Had removed the bridge across this small river, and they charged us a penny to carry us across so we wouldn't get our feet and socks wet, shoes and socks wet. And while they were carrying us across, they picked our pockets. And we went through a little village which had these sort of grass huts. And I don't know if you're interested in this, but at the time I didn't think it was funny, but it's extremely funny. There's a straight path through the village, huts on either side, with another one joining it at an angle, another path joining it at an angle. And I was always pushed in to go first. And I started off through this village, and there were all sorts of queer noises. Hadn't been to Africa before. And when I got to this junction of these two roads, I looked back up the side road, and there were Africans in headdress and shaking things and making a lot of noise, and they were running down this path towards me, so I took to my heels and ran. And of course, all my so-called friends just stood there laughing at me, running through this village with witch doctors, or whatever they were, running after me. They were chasing evil spirits out of the village. Where we went, spent a day in Freetown, well, for a boy seaman, until about 6 o'clock, went back aboard.
When they picked your pockets, what did you lose?
I didn't lose anything. I kept my pay book and what bit of money I had very firmly tucked away.
Well, that's the type of thing they were after, wasn't it?
Yes. And as a boy seaman, we didn't have much to lose. I didn't have a wristwatch in those days. Had very little when I think about it. We came back to the ship. I remember vividly an electrical storm. It was hot, so we were sleeping on deck. An electrical storm, which eventually turned into torrential rain and drove us below. And then we went on our way down to South Africa. Someone was killed in the working space of one of the turrets. You know, turret doesn't just sit on the deck and turn on the deck. It goes right down into the ship and it's trains on rollers below. And then there is a ring around where all the shells go in there. 5 to 5 turrets, or quad, I guess. And going through there to get into the working space, well, obviously the ship is standing still and the turret's training, and if you don't, you're not supposed to go through while the pump, which is, generates the power for training the turret, is on, unless you get permission from the turret. And if you go through and it trains, because it trains very, very quickly, you can be cut in half, of course. We had lost someone on the way to South Africa like that. Called into Cape Town, on the way to South Africa. Very heavy weather, as I remember it, and we had to leave the destroyers behind again. Very big storm. We got into Cape Town, and Smuts came aboard, but no one was allowed on the upper deck to see Smuts. But one or two of us went to the boat deck to peer down at Smuts to see, get a view of the man. And we were looking over onto the quarter deck, and the commander looked up, saw us, and he came, potted to the boat deck to come up onto, potted to the catapult deck to come up onto the boat deck. Everyone ran away, and I thought, well, I'm going to get caught if I run, so I just went over to one of the boats and picked up a rope and started coiling it. And the commander came up to me, and it's obvious he knew I was one of the people involved in it, but he just asked me who the people were aft on the boat deck looking over at the quarter deck, and I said, not really sure, I can't say that I could give you the names. There crowd of people over there, and they ran down the port ladder to the catapult deck as you were coming up the starboard ladder, and he left it at that. I mean, it was a measure of the man. He obviously knew I was one of the group that were watching, and I think probably appreciated my not running away. I don't know, one never knows what one thinks. But he was an interesting man. Ugly, an ugly man, but very, very nice. We moved on from Cape Town, called in Mauritius, then at Addo Atoll. Beautiful. We did stop a merchant ship on the way over. We had one turret closed up, one of the 5 to 5 turrets, but I don't know what happened. She went on away very quickly. We called in at Seychelles, Addo Atoll. And my first sight of a tropical island was palm trees sticking out of the water. I always thought it was an artist's impression, but when we approached, all you could see at first were palm trees sticking out of the water because the land was so low. And you had this lagoon with beautiful clear water, inviting. There were marines ashore. They had been taken there from Crete, I understand, but I'm not sure about that. We moved on to Colombo from there. We were going to stay longer than the one day in Colombo, but for some reason we were pushing on ahead earlier than was anticipated. I think quite early, the day after we got there, about breakfast time, we were told that the ship would be leaving harbour shortly after 1 o'clock or shortly after midday. And as I said before, that's when the captain allowed me to go ashore. So that was the only time I spent in Colombo. We got to Singapore about the beginning of December, and I spent the first evening on the upper deck, tied up alongside by the dock. And there was a leading seaman on deck, and he was saying that when he was last there in 1920-something, he said all this was swamp, and of course it was all built up. There was a big naval establishment there then. I didn't go into Singapore town at all. Oh, I did. I was taken, as a boy seaman, I was taken to the Red Shield Club for tea and cakes. saw very little of Singapore because we were taking the bus there and to the Red Shield Club, came back to the ship. I think it was the, I'm not sure of the date now, night of the 7th, 8th. We opened fire at aircraft that had come over. The Repulse had sailed. I didn't know where she was going. I know that she had sailed, but came back. And we left Singapore heading north.
What was your reaction and that of the people around you to the opening of the Pacific War when Japan made her attack?
I think people like myself were not surprised, because as a boy, I keep saying as a boy seaman, I don't know why, I used to think quite a lot about ships, movement of ships, and there had to be a reason for sending three capital ships. The third one, of course, didn't go. There had to be a reason for sending those ships to the Far East when they could have been better used at home or in the Mediterranean, presumably. So I suppose it didn't come as a big surprise to me.
How confident did you feel about Britain's chances against Japan before you went into action?
Overconfident, I think. After the Bismarck engagement, I was shattered. I hadn't got any confidence at all. I would think, useless to the service after the Bismarck action. And it was only steady routine after that, and comparatively good run to Malta in September, which brought back my confidence. But when we got to Singapore and we sailed north to intervene in the an apparent landing in the north of Malaya, I was full of confidence. I remember the, do you know, words bother me because I start saying the same words over and over again. I remember. On the morning of the 10th, I was about to go below from the working space of S2 turret, and I got my foot on the top step of the companionway from the catapult deck down to the main deck, and I looked aft and I saw an aircraft way in the distance. We had repel aircraft almost immediately then, and I didn't go below. I went straight back to the turret, and it was a question. Eventually the aircraft came in, the starboard battery of which I was part opened up. We, in my opinion, were settling down to a very good barrage. And then all of a sudden we stopped firing. Obviously the planes were now out of our line of sight, but what was happening I didn't know. Shortly after that the port battery were firing, so planes, ship had altered course, the port battery were... It's sad, that is, you know, you don't fire at aircraft and start hitting them immediately. You fire at them and you settle down to a barrage and you work yourself into a barrage. Now, with the starboard battery, we're working to quite a good barrage when we stopped, and the port battery then started opening up. And I think it was lost time, because the port battery couldn't settle down to the barrage where we'd take left off, because there is a rhythm in the barrage. There's, apart from the obvious height, speed, all the other things that have to go into it, you've got this sort of rhythmic movement in the turrets to get the rounds going into the gun as quickly as you can. And the 5.25 were perhaps about 85 pounds weight of a shell. And it would mean that getting into this rhythm, you got a very good barrage going. However, the port battery took over, and we were hit by, presumably, a torpedo. Didn't know at the time. I expected it was. I suppose it could have been a mine for all I knew. But it was nothing like I expected. The stern of the ship came out of the water, and she went back into the water, and she came out again, but not so far, and back into the water. And it was just like, as I thought at the time, a ball being dropped from a height. And if you discount the first one going down, coming up to a certain height, dropping again, and each time the bounce was smaller until she settled in the water and very quickly took on a list to port quarter. I didn't know then that where the torpedo had hit. I knew it was on the port side, but I didn't know that it was a crucial place, as we all know, not all, everybody, but anyone interested knows that it hit the point where the shaft goes into the hull. It distorted the shaft and doing, what, 250 revs? I don't know, really, something like that. It opened up the compartments all the way through the ship, which was the reason for a ship in that enormous amount of water. Things started going wrong from that point. Lost power, training by hand, which was difficult with the list. The space where I was perhaps 2 foot 6 wide and 4 feet long, and it was steel deck. And very early on, I found a piece of quarter seam which I cut and put down on this piece of decking. And